one of Jack's sayings that I heard on the golf course several times and that I heard from him in other discussions was, Lamp, always underact. Don't ever oversell. Always underact. So when Tyson goes down and the count reaches 10, my line is Mike Tyson has been knocked out. And that was underacting. He had some street lingo in him, and he got Floyd. With that, Floyd would never admit that he was gotten at that moment, but Larry got it. Of all the people I know in my frame of reference and my friendship set, I'm the luckiest. I've had by far the luckiest life of anyone I know. And everything you and I have talked about here today is at the heart of that.
Hello, and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tris Dixon.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
Still get goosebumps to this day.
Just, you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beating me. He said, well, let's pull him back.
In the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning, and there's nothing else.
Hello and welcome back to Boxing Life Stories. This week we have yet another Hall of Famer as a guest, and it's the iconic Jim Lampley. For many, Jim is the best sportscaster in the history of boxing, and he was the voice of some of the greatest fights of all time, making some of the sport's most historic calls. You name it, from Tyson and Douglas to Foreman Mora and, of course, Gatti Ward. Jim captured the imagination with his emotion, his articulation, his timing, and his professionalism. As you can tell, I have the utmost admiration for Jim. Along with Larry Merchant, they were my two favourite voices in boxing growing up. And to listen to that voice tell me stories for almost an hour and 20 minutes is a dream come true. I can't thank Jim enough for his time. I think he thought we were going to do about 30 minutes, and he even apologised at the end for going long. And I put that in inverted commas because I could have easily done another 2 hours of this. Jim was one of my top targets some 231 episodes ago, and I'm both thrilled and a little relieved that we have got it done. I feel I can rest. A few things before I leave you with Jim. I have some paperback copies of Damage here and some hardback copies of Warrior, my Matthew Saad Muhammad book. If you'd like one, please send me a DM. If you'd like to buy one, and I can get them sent out. Congratulations to Peter Steele for winning the Roots of Fight competition for the Fight of the Century Jogging Bottoms. This week you have the chance to win a bundle. It's a Kronk jacket and a Kronk vest in a large. And you can win by telling me which colleague of Jim's collected him from the airport the first time they met. So you can win a Kronk vest and a Kronk jacket by the Roots of Fight by telling me which colleague of Jim's picked him up from the airport the first time they met. It's such a cool prize. Thanks to Roots of Fight for doing this with me. Thanks also to my sponsors, Hansenly Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do they find you the best people, Hansenly help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansenly.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, and they're a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They provide expert impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance, and you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. You can get episodes in advance on my Patreon at patreon.com/TrisDixon, where I also upload videos including thoughts and observations from the recent Crawford Spence bill in Las Vegas, where I spent the week, and my thoughts on the White AJ situation this week. I really hope you enjoy this with Jim Lampley as much as I enjoyed recording it. It was one of those that gave me such a buzz, left me with a perma smile. He was incredible, and it was everything I hoped it would be and more. So here's Jim Lampley. Jim, when I started this podcast a while ago now, you were always one of my top targets. And I don't say this lightly, I was always inspired by you on HBO, you and Larry in particular, as journalists, for your emotion and your impartiality. You were guys that I looked up to, so it's great to be able to do this with you. And
according to Thomas Hauser as well, you're still bang on the money in terms of the fights, because last weekend we saw Terence Crawford. And by the way, I'll add this. I yearn to see you on big broadcasts again one day. But we saw Terence Crawford, and ahead of time, you said that you felt that he would be saved either by the referee or his corner before the end of the fight. And you could easily make a case that he should have been saved by someone, but it was a quite magnificent performance. Was that as good as anything that you've seen?
In a while, yes, yep. Absolutely. It was a spectacular performance. I was trying to remember the other night what I had seen in a fight of that magnitude that was comparable to what Terence was able to do, and with a different style and a slightly different effect. The one that came to my mind was Mayweather versus Corrales on a night when a lot of people thought that Chico was in position to really give him a go, and that was going to be a great and even fight. It wasn't. It was a shellacking, and I actually did not see that one coming. I could, if I wanted to cover myself with glory, take credit for the fact that I did say to Tom and a few other people that I thought it would be a beatdown, that I thought it would be likely that somewhere in the late rounds, Spence would need a rescue, whether it happened or not. And I confess that one of the reasons I said that is because I covered several of Terence Crawford's fights from the moment he first emerged into real public consciousness on the undercard of an HBO pay-per-view in Las Vegas on a night when he was put in against Bradus Prescott as the opponent for Prescott, who was on the way up. And Timothy Bradley had Crawford in his camp as a sparring partner and recommended to, I think it was a Bradley-Pacquiao rematch, and he had recommended to Top Rank, you should put this guy in against Crawford, Prescott. He'll give him a real run for his money. Well, not only did he give him a real run for his money, he dominated Bradus Prescott and won the fight and emerged into consciousness. And then from that point forward, I covered several of his fights. So the ability or disability that led to my accurate prediction on this fight is very simply that I've never covered an Errol Spence fight. I've never been around Errol Spence. I don't know him personally. I don't know his very illustrious trainer, Derek James. And I knew everything, or at least I felt I knew everything about Crawford. And one of the things I most know about Crawford is that he has, when he needs it, a sinister edge. He has an inner fire that he can call upon in close fights, which will tilt the battle in his direction. And I expected to see that at some time the other night. I didn't expect necessarily that it would happen in the second round, but I knew that at some point I was gonna see the mean side of Terence Crawford. And he knows it's in him. He's been there. And he also has craft, and he has increasing power. As soon as I knew that he was coming in after a weigh-in at 146.8, but he was coming in at 165, I felt very confident with what I had said to people about the fight. Still not knowing all that much about Spence, other than that he was a much more celebrated prospect back in the day than Terence. That played in Crawford's favor. That he was much more of a sort of boxing stylist than an attacker or a slugger. That played in Crawford's favor. Every single factor in the fight that had been seen by a lot of people to favor Errol Spence turned out to be an edge for Terence Crawford. So I was in the position to know so little that I looked at the fight from one perhaps jaundiced view and came up with exactly the right answer to what's going to happen in the fight. You have to have a little luck sometimes, and I did.
When you're watching big fights like that on Saturday night, are you yearning to be ringside doing what you do?
But big fights are psychological. You know, I always said to people when I was in the mix, covering, calling blow by blow. We at HBO and it gravitated eventually to all the other places that call fights. We had a last element of the preparation. You know, you would read what you needed to read. You would look at the video that you needed to look at the video. And then the day before the fight, you would sit down in a conference room at the hotel or the arena, and the two fighters are brought into you separately with their trainers, with their promoter, usually with the people in their camps, et cetera. And they sit down at a table and look across the table at you, and you ask them questions. And people used to ask me all the time, who's going to win this fight? How do you think I should bet? Da, 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 da. And I would always say, I'm not going to say a word about that. I'm not going to tell you anything about that until I have had that meeting, because there's nothing in the world for the intimacy of boxing like sitting down with the fighters, looking at their faces, see how they respond to questions, logical questions about their preparation, about what they've been doing, about where the fight fits into their lives. Well, I didn't have that in this particular instance. Who knows whether I would have been persuaded or snowed in the room by Errol or Derek. I just remembered the many times that I went into that kind of a room with Terence Crawford and saw his confidence, his very clear picture of who he is, his understanding of how he wanted to use his tactical and strategic capabilities to win the fight. And I have a lot of confidence in his ability to keep doing what he's been doing. 146.8 up to 165. That was good too, even though Spence did basically the same thing, 147 up to 165. I think it was visible that Crawford got more out of that than Spence did. And those were devastating counter shots. You know, there are two different kinds of great counter punchers. One of them is the great counter puncher who lands the accurate shot and is already pulling away, is already removing his body weight from the equation to make sure that he doesn't get tagged in return. The other is the great counterpuncher who lands that shot with such authority that he knocks the opponent back and he doesn't have to worry about what's coming back. Terence, from the second round on, when he really began landing his counter shots, never had to worry about what was coming back, because he was always knocking Spence back on his heels and eventually hurting him with those counter punches. And that's greatness. That's not something you can easily achieve.
I can see, even in this short spell that we've been speaking, Jim, that you are passionate about it. How much do you miss doing it week by week? And has it softened the more time that's come between you finishing at HBO or HBO finishing with boxing and where you're at now? Or does it still nag?
Well, obviously I don't know as much now, because I, you know, haven't called any fights in more than 4 years. So I don't have the backlog of knowledge for quite a number of fighters in the sport that I have for Crawford. And again, if this had turned out to be a devastating performance by Errol Spence, then you wouldn't be talking to me today.
I would be, Jim. I've been tracking you for ages.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I understand that you've been constantly interested, and I appreciate that. But, you know, I'm getting significant attention the last couple of days just because Hauser wrote that column saying, Jim seemed clairvoyant and seemed to know exactly what was going to happen in the fight. Again, I could lie and say, yeah, I knew exactly what was going to happen in the fight, but a lot of it was just that I know Crawford better than I know Spence, and I have a great deal of respect for what I know Crawford can do. But yes, I absolutely miss calling the fights. As you can tell, I'm still energetically and devotedly a boxing fan. I still follow the major fights and listen to my colleagues and pay attention to what's happening. I think my quote to Hauser when he said, what do you miss about calling the fights? I said, everything. And, you know, looking back, I might wish that I had said, oh, I missed the preparation and I missed the people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't desperately need to be there. That really isn't true. I miss it emotionally every time I watch a big fight, because that used to be my place to be. But nothing lasts forever. Nobody is ever invited to do anything forever. For whatever reason, no streaming service or cable network or anybody has invited me to call fights, with the sole exception of one fight for which I made an agreement and the fight never took place. And that was that I made agreement with Triller to call the rematch of George Kambosos and Teofimo Lopez. And then the fight didn't take place because I think Lopez caught COVID. And I wound up, because my representatives had done a fantastic job of setting up the deal, I wound up getting paid for it anyway. And maybe that ultimately operated against me in the marketplace. I don't know. But at the end of the day, I'd love to call fights. I'm not calling fights because nobody's asked me to call fights. And to a certain degree, if you look at the number on my driver's license, that's probably logical.
So, I mean, yeah, I'm not going to agree with you in that respect, in the sense that, or anyone who's not making the call based on that. It's interesting when you mention the people. Obviously, you know, we knew that HBO was family. We felt that through the TV screen. We felt that you and Larry were best buds. We felt that you, George, Roy, Emmanuel would all sit around a dinner table, whether you were working or not. You just, you know, you enjoyed each other's company. And it was that team, wasn't it? It was that team. In fact, Roy was particularly common. We were going to meet, weren't we, in Canastota last year, if you remember, and then you got COVID. And Roy, during his speech, was very, very complimentary about you, more so than anybody else. Not that he knocked anyone, but particularly about you. And the one thing that blew him away was your, what he called, a photographic memory. Is that right? You have some sort of photographic memory, or was this just a skill that Roy could never get his head around about how good you were with your summarizations?
I have a good memory. Other people have called it a photographic memory. Roy is a brother to me, closer than a friend. He's family. So I'm very grateful to him for any nice thing that he said about me on his day of honor. It was awful, awful, because of Roy, because of Bernard, because of several others, that I caught COVID and was not able to be in Canastota that day. I still deeply regret that. I talked to Roy on the phone every once in a while. And, you know, if at the end of the day you were to say that I have a photographic memory for boxing, it's probably because I love boxing and always have. I can remember the very first fight I ever watched on television when I was 6 years old, Sugar Ray Robinson versus Bobo Olsen, their second fight for the welterweight championship of the world. I can remember at age 11 or 12 watching the epic and tragic fight between Emil Griffith and Benny Kidd Perrette. I think I probably already told you in a previous conversation that the very first live prize fight I ever attended was Sonny Liston versus Cassius Clay on February 25, 1964 in Miami Beach. So these memories run deep, and I will never shed them. And yes, when I was calling the fights, you know, a part of the preparation is you've got both fighters' fight lists. You've got, you know, their entire competitive record in front of you on a sheet of paper. And I was able to go through those and visualize in my mind all the things that I had seen from them coming into the fights. And when you cover a fighter, I'm sure I covered Crawford 8-9 times. Pacquiao, probably 15 or 20 times. I just watched the Oscar De La Hoya documentaries the other night, parts one and two, both. And it's all my voice. So, yes, I am electrically and deeply emotionally connected to all those memories. And I hope they never go away. They're a part of the fabric of my life.
You must be exceptionally proud when you look back on that. I mean, you were obviously the voice of a generation, you know, or a couple of generations. And, you know, iconic nights.
I had the privilege of sitting in the best chair from which to call boxing matches for a long time. When I was assigned first to call boxing at ABC Sports, I had been at ABC Sports for 13 years. I was only 37 or 38 years old. I was in the process of building a great network television career. A new chief executive arrived for the sports division there, armed with one basic perception about ABC Sports, which was, who's Jim Lampley and how do I get rid of him? And highly ironically, that man assigned me to boxing because he was pretty sure that the sport would be allergic to me stylistically. I would be allergic to the sport. No way a preppy kid like me would know anything about boxing. And he wanted to embarrass me and make me look bad. And coincidentally, gift from the heavens, he did that at the moment when the network had signed an exploratory look-see contract with a 19-year-old heavyweight from upstate New York whose name was Mike Tyson. So my very first televised boxing match as blow-by-blow commentator was Mike Tyson versus Jesse Ferguson, the first time that Mike appeared on network television. And as soon as a great expert commentator, also an executive named Alex Wallow, stepped into the ring to do the post-fight interview, asked Mike about the uppercut that had shattered Jesse's nose in round four and caused the fight to be stopped with blood all over the ring in round five. As soon as Alex asked Mike about the uppercut, and Mike said, well, Cat D'Amato taught me that the purpose of the uppercut is to drive the opponent's nose bone into his brain. And I was trying to drive Jesse's nose bone into his brain. As soon as I heard that, I thought, oh my gosh, look what I've happened into here. This guy is not going to be, he's not just going to be the number one quote machine in boxing. He's going to be the number one quote machine in sports. That was my instant perception based on that one interview answer. And sure enough, in the next several weeks, they all started rolling out. Boxing is a hurt business. Everybody's got a plan until you hit them, et cetera, et cetera. All the things that D'Amato had taught him to say, by the way. So I became a very lucky person. Tyson did about five or six fights on ABC with me calling them. Everybody remembers him as a complete destroyer. Nobody remembers that James Quick Tillis took him the distance, and there were a couple of scorers at ringside who had Tillis winning the fight. It was very close to even. No one remembered that he went the distance with Mitch Blood Green. He went the distance with Jose Ribalta until the last 10 seconds, etc. The tea leaves were already there before I went to Tokyo to call Tyson Douglas. And HBO signed me to become their blow-by-blow commentator, dislodging a very competent blow-by-blow commentator named Barry Tompkins, who was a great friend of mine and remains so to this day. And they dislodged Barry from that chair and put me there because I had a bond with Tyson. I had called his fights at ABC, and now he had moved to HBO. And so that gave me the edge that became, okay, let's offload Barry and signed Jim to call the fights. And then for 30-plus more years, I called the fights on HBO. Never dreaming that that great pay cable network was going to be purchased by a cadre of cell phone salesmen from Dallas, whose first big decision was, we didn't want to do boxing anymore. Go figure. So that's what happened to that.
Wow. So I think that Jesse Ferguson fight, was that in Glen Falls, New York? Do you remember?
Glens Falls, New York. Mike Tyson versus Jesse Ferguson. Yes. And And then, you know, there was a series of them. Some were in Glens Falls, some were in Albany. They were upstate New York fights. And Alex Wallow had a British Racing Green Jaguar sedan that we used to ride up to upstate New York in his car to call the fights. And when we were going up for the Marvis Frazier fight, Alex in the car started saying to me, he said, you know, I'm new to this being a television commentator. I'm an executive. The only reason I'm with you is because I signed the contracts for the boxing matches. I'm the only boxing fan on the sports staff. What would you think going into this particular fight against Marvis Frazier? What would you think if I predicted in the opening on camera that Mike is going to knock him out in the first round? And I said, well, Alex, you're the expert. Okay. I mean, the beauty of you being the expert is I can't tell you what to do. Producer can't tell you what to do. You say whatever you want to say on the air. And if you believe that Mike is going to knock him out in the first round, then that's what you should say. So he thinks about it for another hour or so. And we're driving along, headed up there, et cetera. And he's fidgeting about it. He's chewing on it. But eventually he says, you know, maybe it's not safe to say that he'll knock him out in the first round. And I said, look, nobody's going to, as long as he beats him and he knocks him out, and, you know, I know you're sure that that's going to happen, nobody's going to downgrade you if you say first round and he does it in third round or fourth. There's nothing to lose here. If you want to get attention, then say he's going to knock him out in the first round. So now I've got him thinking about it. And as we're pulling into the hotel, he turns to me and says, what if I say he's going to knock him out in the first minute of the first round? I said, well, okay, now you are out on a limb. All right. Now, if it doesn't happen, you might get whacked in a newspaper Monday. But why care? Why even worry about it? Say whatever you believe. So at the end of the day, 10 minutes before the show begins, he's still chewing on it. You know, do I say first round or do I say first minute of the first round? And I'm like, Alex, I'm not going to tell you what to say. You've got to make up your own mind. At the end, he sort of slides away from his most heartfelt position. And he winds up saying in the opening on camera, Mike Tyson will knock Marvis Frazier out in the first round. Do you remember how long it was?
30 seconds.
33 seconds.
Yeah.
Okay. That knockout took place in 33 seconds. And all the way back to the city, which is about a 3-hour drive, Alex is moaning and groaning. Why didn't I say first minute of first round? I robbed myself. Like, Alex, nobody's, you said first round. Okay. Nobody's going to be ripping you tomorrow and saying, oh, Alex really missed it because he said first round and that was 2 minutes and 20 seconds off of what actually happened. But again, there goes, this is your photographic memory thing at play. How could I possibly remember every detail of that conversation? I do. That's all.
I suppose the simple question to follow that would be, what was Mike like? But actually, I'm interested, what was Cus like? Because I actually wound up training with Kevin Rooney in the Catskills for a while from 2000 to 2001. And so I went up there and sort of lived that life for several months because I was so infatuated with the story from my childhood. What was Cus like?
I didn't get to spend that much time with him. I only saw him at those fighter meetings before the fights. Sometimes he didn't even come. You know, there were some old world writers like George Plimpton, and Dave Anderson and others in New York who knew him and had more contact and information on him. Alex Wallow knew him and had conversations with Cus. And of course, most of what you got from Mike in those early years was bottled and packaged Cus D'Amato, because, you know, Cus formed him and created the persona to a certain degree. So to me, he was mystical. He was remote. He was one of those once in a lifetime characters. He was gruff. He was one of the people who took one look at me and figured, you know, what is this kid doing here? He's not going to know anything about boxing. That shirt is too nice. You know, there was a lot of that in trying to get to him. But the other people, Steve Lott, Jay Bright, you know, the people around Mike in the camp, they were nice, they were friendly, they were warmly accepting of me, and I learned a few things from them.
So when the HBO thing came across, did they headhunt you and say, we want you and we just want you to do what you do? Or did you have to audition? Was there a pool of people, or was it just, you're our guy?
Well, once the new executive at ABC Sports decides he wants to get rid of me and I get put into a chair where he thinks I'm going to fail miserably, and I don't fail. And part of why I don't fail is because the story is Tyson. And how can you not effectively tell that story? Now that turns the whole thing around, shifts the paradigm dramatically. And HBO is making colossal offers for me to leave ABC and come to call the fights with them. And I did a couple more Tyson fights before I did that. But at the end of the day, you know, I knew the difference between Saturday afternoon on Wide World of Sports, sometimes tape delayed, and live on Saturday night on the number one purveyor of boxing matches, even then. You know, HBO already had Larry Merchant and Barry Tompkins and Sugar Ray Leonard. And they're asking me to work with Sugar Ray and Larry, and I was thrilled. I couldn't have been more excited about it. And there was nobody else who was considered, because I was the one who had called Tyson's fights on ABC.
Yeah, that's great. And in terms of the Tokyo memories, are they sort of fond memories, the fact that you could say you were there? Because obviously not many journalists took it even seriously, or not many newspapers took it seriously and even sent people. And so you're
just say this, okay? Yeah. I would love to tell you that I knew what was going to happen in Tokyo. That would be a lie. That would be a complete lie. But I did know, I was intelligent enough to have seen, as I say, that the notion that this was 42-1 and that Mike was automatically going to wipe him out and that Buster Douglas had no business in the ring with Mike, I had seen evidence to the contrary. The Mitch Blood Green fight in Madison Square Garden was not on HBO. It was a Madison Square Garden telecast. And I went and sat in the stands, and I was able to take it in and process the fact that, hey, he went the distance with Tillis. He's going the distance with Mitch Blood Green. He went the distance with Tony Tucker. He went to the last 10 seconds with Ribalta. If guys are significantly taller, have some craft, particularly if they can bring a right hand over the top the way Douglas did, this is not a wipeout. This is not going to be a one or two round fight. So I had already seen evidence that put me in a position so that once you saw what happened in the first two rounds of Tyson Douglas, I wasn't shocked. You know, I could process that, okay, here we are again. This guy is 5, 6, 7 inches taller. He brings the right hand over the top, and it's not easy for Mike to see that. He's an athlete. He's got a pretty good job. It wasn't Mike who had played college basketball. It was Buster who had played college basketball. He had about a 20 or 30 pound weight advantage. So, you know, it was surprising, but it was not a cosmic shock, because you could process all those other factors. And oh, by the way, add into that the disturbances in Mike's life, the level of distraction in Mike's life, all the other things he was thinking about besides Buster Douglas, how easy it was to listen to the notion that Douglas had no chance whatsoever. Oh, and by the way, Cuss isn't in the corner anymore. He's got Jay Bright and Aaron Snowell. And once his eye begins to swell, they don't even have an inswell. How could they possibly have been that unprepared for the things that happened in the fight? So if you had your eyes open, if you're processing everything and taking it all as it comes, then you get to see the full picture. And getting into the late rounds, again, the very first live prize fight I ever went to was Sonny Liston versus Cassius Clay in Miami Beach, which I knew very well was, even at that time when I was a kid, I knew that that was the biggest upset in boxing history. So you get to round 8, 9, 10 in Tokyo, and I am very graphically possessed of the notion, oh my God, the first live prize fight I ever attended was the biggest upset in the history of boxing. And now here is the fight which will succeed it as the biggest upset in the history of boxing. And I'm narrating this fight for the entire American audience. I was meant to be here. You know, I did think that. I thought I was meant to be here. And then I began thinking of, okay, what I want to do, if this ends abruptly, if he winds up on his keister, as we say, how am I going to treat that? And I was telling myself, I was saying to myself, understate it, underact. One of my greatest friends in the world is Jack Nicholson. And one of Jack's sayings that I heard on the golf course several times and that I heard from him in other discussions was, Lamp, always underact. Don't ever oversell. Always underact. So when Tyson goes down and the count reaches 10, my line is Mike Tyson has been knocked out. And that was underacting, right?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people would have screamed and yelled and gone berserk. I said, Mike Tyson has been knocked out, because I can hear Nicholson in my mind saying, don't overact, always underact.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. I feel like I overacted with the introduction there, say it fawning over you about as a kid looking up to you. But that was overacting. But in terms of the, although very legitimate, I'll add.
By the way, you know what else is underacting?
Go
just
on.
To talk about famous calls, memorable calls for me. It happened. It happened.
Well, that was where I was coming from, because you'd literally just said cosmic shock. And so as soon as you said cosmic shock, I was thinking Foreman Mora, because was that more of a shock to you then, given obviously, I suppose with hindsight, we knew that Mike was unraveling and that Buster was inspired by the death of his mother and all the stuff that went into that. But with George, he was taking a steady beating until he wasn't.
Well, the reason that those words are, it happened. George was my expert commentator. We were working together repeatedly while he was preparing for the fight. Well, we negotiated the fight, made the deal for the fight, et cetera, et cetera. And eventually our relationship was good enough that I could say to him at ringside in a matter of fact way, and I said it several times, George, how in the world are you going to deal with Moore? He's a southpaw. He's got good feet. He is a mover. Holyfield couldn't find him. How do you expect to be able to handle that particular style in this fight? And I probably asked him that at ringside in the weeks leading up to the fight, half dozen times. And you know, at pre-fight meals, sitting together and eating at ringside in casual moments, I would find moments say, what are your new thoughts? How are you going to handle Moore? And over, George said to me, Jim, you watch. There will come a moment late in that fight. He will come and stand in front of me and let me knock him out. Always the same words. He will come and stand in front of me. Sometimes he would say he'll stand still in front of me and let me knock him out. Now go back and look at the video. I mean, is that fix? Is that clairvoyant? How in the world could he have known exactly what would happen? But of course he was wearing the shorts from Zaire. And central in his mind was, I'm gonna turn the tables. You know, tonight I'm not going to be the one who gets played. I'm not going to be the guy about whom somebody gets to brag that he fooled me, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to be the one who turns the tables. And in his mind, of course, he wasn't turning the tables on Moore. He was turning the tables on Ali. He was finally getting his revenge for what had happened 20 years before. So looking back, looking at the fight several times, as I have, there's no question. He was somewhat complicit in allowing Moore to bat him around like a tennis ball for 9 rounds, to rain all those punches on him, which he knew were not going to knock him out. That he knew he could take that shot and he could deal with that. And he could lure Moore more and more into range, and he could make Moore feel more and more secure until the moment would come, as he said, when Moore would come and stand in front of him and let him knock him out. Now, go back and look. Early in the 10th round, George throws 2 or 3 big roundhouse left hooks. It was a punch that he had not featured at all in the fight. It was not a punch he had thrown in the fight. So I've looked back at it several times and said to myself, what was he doing with those big left hooks? And I think what he was doing, frankly, was to position Moore 1 foot over toward his right hand so that he could throw the right hand straight from the shoulder instead of having to bring it across and bend it to land that shot. So he gets Moore into the position he wants. He has influenced him with the left hooks. And now Moore is right in front of the right hand. And he steps forward and lands 1-2. Jab, straight right hand, boom. Michael later told me that he was basically done after the first 1-2. George looks at him, assesses him, steps forward a little closer, throws the jab again, throws the right hand straight from the shoulder again. And now we're done. And I'm standing there looking at that and thinking, why didn't I plan for this? Why did I never believe him? Why did I not sit down at my desk in the hotel room last night and dream up what is the ideal descriptive closing line for what we're looking at here? Because I should have paid more attention. I should have believed it. But I didn't. So what am I going to say now? And it popped into my mind. It came from out of nowhere and popped into my mind, thinking about what he had told me over and over. He's going to come stand in front of me and let me knock him out. It happened. It happened. Totally spontaneous. A gift from the universe and from my previous career. Definitely the best line I ever concocted or employed in a boxing match. Unplanned. It happened. It happened.
There's
Thank
a
you,
lesson.
George.
There's a lesson there, isn't there, about being unscripted and calling what you're seeing, but also doing having your due diligence and knowing the story.
Have you ever heard of Branch Rickey, the general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, who signed Jackie Robinson and brought him to Major League Baseball? Branch Rickey was the most famous baseball executive of his day. And he's famous for one particular quote, and that quote is, luck is the residue of design. So in that instance, I was lucky. But the luck was the residue of design.
Yeah.
And the design was me asking Foreman over and over, how are you going to handle Moore? What are you going to do? I wanted to know what he thought could happen. And because of that design, I was lucky enough to have the right line.
You've had, you know, a great cast of fighters to work with. Some have been more difficult than others. So obviously the ones that spring to mind might be the ones along the lines of Bernard Hopkins and Floyd Mayweather, complex guys. And obviously Floyd had his run in with Larry. I suppose, well, what were your thoughts on those guys and that particular exchange with Larry, where if he was 50 years younger, things might have turned out differently.
Well, I think Larry got I'd love to think I would have been smart enough to come up with what Larry came up with in that moment. It was spontaneous. It was unplanned. And, about as good as it could possibly get. I was 50 years younger. I'd kick your ass. That was just an amazing thing. And it reminded us that Larry was born and raised in Brooklyn and had worked many years in Philadelphia and then came to New York. Larry knew the streets. Larry was not just a suburban guy. So he had some street lingo in him, and he got Floyd. Floyd would never admit that he was gotten at that moment, but Larry got it. And the side story that's great is less than 24 hours after Larry said that, you could go to the Santa Monica Pier in Los Angeles and buy on the Santa Monica Pier a T-shirt with a picture of Larry looking into the camera and Mayweather behind him and Larry saying, "If I was 50 years younger, I'd kick your ass." The caption was on the T-shirt. The picture was on the T-shirt less than 24 hours later, which goes to show you how rapidly the marketplace will respond to genius. And Larry wasn't getting any kickback or payment from that. That was entrepreneurialism at its best. Floyd did not want to be liked. He wanted to be disliked, and he was pretty good at cultivating that. I had some positive moments with Floyd, but most of the time he wanted to make sure that I knew that all of us were annoyances to him. The one thing I will always most appreciate from him was, the Mayweather-Pacquiao telecast was a shared telecast with the Showtime, very odd diplomatic venture. So commentators from Showtime, where he had fought most of his recent fights leading into that, commentators from HBO, where he had fought earlier in his career, sitting across the table from him in the room, debriefing him, asking him questions about the fight. And that day, for whatever reason, when we did that meeting, he sat directly in front of me and he stared across the table at me. And he, even if Mauro Ranallo asked a question or Al Bernstein asked a question, whoever it was, Larry, whoever, he answered to me over and over and over. He looked at me and answered as if to say, "All right, I understand that you're the play-by-play guy. You're the central figure in the telecast. I'm going to give you this information." So I was grateful to Floyd for, I don't want to say honoring me. I'm sure he wasn't honoring me. He was being tactical. He was being businesslike. But I was glad that I got the identification of that. Bernard was both. Bernard was prickly. Bernard was sometimes hard to pin down. Bernard could be disrespectful, but over time, if you earned cred with Bernard, then he got sweeter and sweeter and nicer and more trusting. It was all about trust. And by the end of his career, we were close. We were friends. He liked me. I liked him. And when I put together my magazine type show on HBO, The Fight Game, at some point, we knew that we needed a craft expert, somebody who could do feature pieces about technique, craft, tactics, things that go on in the fights. And the obvious choice was Bernard. So I put him on the air on television as a feature reporter and an editorial voice on The Fight Game. And he was great. That was one of the reasons I was so regretful when I got COVID and could not go the weekend that he was inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame. I love Bernard Hopkins and always will.
Did you enjoy the crazy Ricky Hatton days in Vegas?
Ricky Hatton was fun.
Unlike anything else, right?
Yeah. Well, eventually, 23andMe, you know that website? It's
yes.
A genealogy website. Eventually, I learned that I too originate in Manchester. The Lampleys, L-A-M-P-L-E-Y, Northern England name. And I was there to do Hatton against a Latin fighter in Manchester. And I went out and strolled around in a Manchester cemetery and saw gravestones from centuries past with my last name on them. So I realized, and then reinforced to be a 23andMe, that Lampleys are from Manchester. So I shared that in common with Ricky, and that, you know, was part of just part of what made him fun. Larry loved covering Ricky's fights. Obviously, Ricky was as crowd pleasing a fighter as you could ask for. He walked straight in. He wanted maximum havoc, and he helped to provide it. And I didn't have the kind of friendship with him that I had with some other fighters, because he would come into the meetings and go back out and didn't spend a lot of time with us. But I had a kinship with Ricky because I'm from Manchester too.
So do you have a go-to sort of list of four or five favorite fights that you've seen? Is there, I mean, obviously there's so many iconic ones, all of the legendary nights for a start, but do you have a go-to list of, you know, that you readily reel off?
It's really interesting. I have a lot of favorite fights, way too many to try to describe. But the ones that most stick in the memory are the ones that hurt my heart. And I'm thinking of Meldrick Taylor versus Julio Cesar Chavez, a fight that hurts my heart to this day. I'm thinking of Miguel Cotto versus Antonio Margarito the first time. And that's a crime. That's something that should never, ever be allowed to take place. And I'm just glad that Miguel survived it and then got a form of revenge later in Madison Square Garden. Fights like that, I remember them the nights that I'm lying awake thinking of boxing before I go to sleep. I remember the decision in De La Hoya versus Trinidad. And I have friends who say it was the right decision, but I remember at the time thinking that that was not the right decision. And most particularly, I point to the fact that the person who was then the most respected judge in boxing, Jerry Roth, gave three of the first four rounds to Trinidad. Go back and watch the fight. Tell me how any qualified judge could give three of the first four rounds to Felix Trinidad. That isn't fathomable. So things like that stay with me. But then there are triumphs and heroic performances that I'm equally attached to.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, the call of Ward Gatti one is another of your immortals.
The call of Ward Gatti one is a cosmic experience for me and Larry and Emmanuel. And it's, if you want to see a fight that demonstrates the unique courage and soulfulness of boxers and the paradigm of how great, elaborately punishing fights almost always lead to a form of romance between the two fighters, that it's impossible to fight each other in a fight like that and not, to some degree, fall in love. And Mickey and Arturo definitely fell in love, and they fell in love that night because they so admired each other's courage and stick-to-itiveness. But it's crazy courage, and it's damaging courage, and they both paid an awful price for their three fights. So at the same time that it shows you a lot of what's wonderful about boxing, it also shows you a lot of what's cruel about boxing. And you know, I don't think Arturo ever had anywhere near the same reflexes or the same visual capability or the same hand speed, anything after that fight. And I'll never forget, after that fight was over and we kind of stood around and drank it in for a little while and watched the crowd file out of that arena at the Mohegan Sun Casino in Connecticut. And finally, I picked up my portfolio of papers and my notes, and Larry and Emmanuel were going to get something to eat. And I was leaving very early the next morning. I told them I was going back to my room, and I walked out into the hallway and I found Pat Lynch. Pat Lynch, great Irish name, who was Arturo's manager and who loved Arturo deeply. And Pat was weeping in the hallway outside the arena. And I put my arm around him and said, "Pat, what is it that has you so deeply aggrieved? Why are you here like this?" And he said, "I just can't believe we lost." And I said, "Pat, lost? Who do you think is going to remember that? In a fight like this, nobody lost. Both fighters won. I promise you, you find any of these fans who are in the arena tonight, 15, 20 years from now, and ask them who won the fight. Nobody's going to remember. Nobody could ever remember the technicality of who won a fight like that. Pat, they both won and they both lost." And that was the truth of Gaddy Ward One. I loved Emmanuel desperately. He was the closest male friend I've ever had in my life. And of course, I can't think of that fight without hearing, "Oh my God!" Yeah. He was a great, great friend, and I miss him desperately to this day.
I suppose the line that stands out to me and maybe others over Emmanuel's even was, "Stop it, Frank. You can stop at any time." Stuff of legend.
Emmanuel was one of the greatest people I've ever known. And, you know, the story of Emmanuel is an incredible story. And the first weekend I met Emmanuel, I was still doing fights at ABC. Tommy Hearns versus Dennis Andres for light heavyweight championship in Joe Louis Arena in Detroit. I was flying in on Thursday night from New York to Detroit. I had never met Emmanuel Stewart. This was going to be the first time I would ever meet him. I had obviously seen him from watching Tommy Hearns fights, but I had not ever met him. And he knew some people at the network at ABC, and he had called and gotten them to give him my travel information so that when I arrived in baggage claim at the Detroit airport, Emmanuel had shooed away the assigned sedan driver and told me, "I'm here to take you to your hotel." I'm like, "Emmanuel, I have a driver coming. You don't have to take me." He says, "No, I got rid of the driver. I'm taking you to the hotel. I'm a fan. I wanted to get to know you." And from that night onward, we were brothers. And 2 days later, in Joe Louis Arena in Detroit, Tommy wound up beating Dennis Andres to win the light heavyweight championship. But before the fight, Aretha Franklin sang the longest version of the United States national anthem ever to have been sung before a sports event in America. And I know that because there was a guy named Stan Isaacs at Newsday, a newspaper on Long Island, who made a hobby, a personal habit and hobby of collecting national anthems from sports events. And he timed them and he had a list of which were the longest ones. And the longest one prior to that was the famous Marvin Gaye national anthem before an NBA All-Star game in the Pontiac Silverdome in Michigan. And Marvin had gone 2 minutes and 41 seconds. And as I was standing at ringside watching Aretha do this particular national anthem, it struck me and became clear eventually that she was gunning for Marvin. She was going to make sure that this national anthem was longer than Marvin's, and sure enough, it was 7 seconds longer.
You know, the one that I'll never forget was when I think it was Genuine who sang it in the aftermath of 9/11 for Hopkins Trinidad at the Garden. That was a hugely emotionally charged night, wasn't it? Even as an Englishman,
emotionally charged night. It was really the first major sports event in New York following 9/11, and well, other than Yankee games, and the Yankees had memorable, theatrical, spectacular national anthems. This was the first boxing match, and it was great. Yes.
Yeah. And in terms of, I know we touched base when my book Damage came out, which is obviously about CTE and long-term injuries in boxing. And I know that's something that you've discussed in broadcast before. It's still a bit of a taboo subject with people that I speak to in boxing, but, did you have residual guilt from your role? I think a lot of journalists will admit that they probably do have guilt from covering the fights and watching the fighters give of themselves what they do give.
Yes. Do I feel some residual guilt for glorifying a sport that does physical and neurological damage to people? Yes. I don't see how any human being could do what I did, could make money from what I did, could get notoriety from what I did, could leave a public profile from what I did without, in the back of their mind or in the front of their mind, questioning the validity and the ethics of doing that. But of course, that's sophist and selfish in a certain way, because I didn't make them fighters. I didn't create the life circumstances that led them to this path. And I didn't create the success patterns that brought them to the arenas where I covered boxing on ABC, on HBO. I wasn't directly responsible for the choices that these human beings made. And the one thing that I've always said in response to that particular question is, having sat rooms with fighters, prepared for big fights hundreds of times, I'm very sure that I never met a single boxer who did not understand the danger. I'm sure of that. I never met a single boxer who I thought was, with the exception of maybe a few who were governed by their fathers so fiercely that they might not have wound up with a choice. But most of those don't make it to the top level. I don't think I met too many people who did not understand the stakes of what they were doing, understand the danger of what they were doing, and up to and including understanding that maybe Perrette didn't walk into a fight with Emil Griffith thinking, I'm going to get killed. I called four different fights in which one combatant died. Jesus Chavez versus Lander Thompson in Las Vegas. Jimmy Garcia on an undercard in Las Vegas. There were four different fights that I called, either preliminary or main event, in which a fighter died. And I didn't lose sleep because, again, I was certain that all of them understood the danger of what they did. I wrote an article about Chavez versus Lee Vanderson, and with enormous sympathy and pain for Johnson, I pointed out, he was a very poor, impoverished, disadvantaged from the streets of one of America's worst slums in Atlantic City. There was no other way through which he could have climbed to the heights of income and public recognition and possibilities that he climbed to. Because of boxing, his two children went to better schools than they would ever have had the chance to go to without boxing. His two children and his wife lived better home than they would ever have had a chance to live in without boxing. He saw Paris. He saw Rome. He fought in Madison Square Garden. None of those things would ever have happened to Levander Johnson without boxing. So it had said to him at the very beginning, these are the possibilities. This is the possible upside. And this is the possible downside. What are you going to do? There's no doubt in my mind. And by the way, he was in Las Vegas. Dr. Margaret Goodman, the single best ring physician ever, was seated at ringside. He had one of the best referees in the world. I forget which one. He had all the right circumstances, and it happened. So it can happen anytime. Anytime somebody steps into the ring. But hey, how many times did I get on airplanes to fly to sports events? How many commercial airliners go down? It could always happen. Everything is possible, and death is possible from 1,000 different circumstances that most of us face almost every day without thinking of them. So, I have had a twinge of regret here and there, but at the end of the day, I didn't make the call. Life made the call for all of them.
Did you find it easy to slip back into civilian life, obviously in North Carolina at the university? Was it an easy transition, or was it, I don't know. I mean, was it surreal?
I always wanted to consider the possibility of coming back to the place where I flunked out of school as a teenager, dropped out of school because I was no longer in position to graduate, eventually earned the chance to come back to school, made a long string of A's to graduate from this university, went to graduate school to set up my chance of working in network television, the path that ultimately took me to everything I ever did, 14 Olympics, all the prize fights, et cetera, et cetera. I always wanted the possibility of coming back here and standing in the classroom and teaching to kind of pay off the unpredictable and bizarre poetry of that whole life experience. And I did. And I taught a course that I created for 5 semesters. And the faculty of the communication department agreed it was an important course. So all the psychic satisfaction and irony value that I had hoped for and expected in one college town I most worship and love of any place in the world. And oh, by the way, for the first couple of years, I lived 30 feet from the entrance to the campus. So everything that I dreamed of, everything, going back to 1968, when I was down and out and had to carve out a path to try to come back to school, everything I dreamed of has happened. All my dreams have come true, including this. So, I'm not entitled to any of all the people I know in my frame of reference and my friendship set. I'm the luckiest. I've had by far the luckiest life of anyone I know. And everything you and I have talked about here today is at the heart of that.
So, yeah, I was going to ask you how rewarding you find it. And I think you've answered that to a T, right? And it's not just professionally, but personally, in terms of you allowing to take your story full circle, right?
I'm not good at hiding tears. You've seen them. I am deeply moved by the good fortune of my life. I'm deeply moved that anyone wants to hear about it. So I'm grateful to you for giving me that chance.
Jim, this has been wonderful. I'm so grateful that we've managed to get it done. And enormously grateful for your time and your contributions in your Hall of Fame career. It's been terrific. And to drop a name like Jack Nicholson just obviously sent me spinning, didn't it? I wasn't ready for that.
Well, I would say luck. I mean, good fortune, et cetera, et cetera. The greatest actor of his generation, the greatest actor of my lifetime, became my friend. And, you can't write something like that up. You can't draw it on a list of expectations. It's not, it's too illogical, you know. It can't happen, but it happened. I met him in an art gallery in New York. We had a conversation. He knew who I was from boxing and from other sports, the Olympics and stuff. I was surprised. He knew a lot about me. I knew a lot about him, obviously. And then years later, I bumped into him at a range in Los Angeles. And we're hitting balls next to each other at a driving range. And he turned around and said, you want to play around sometime? And I said, yeah. You know anybody who would turn down a round of golf with Jack Nicholson? They'd have to be crazy. And we wound up playing dozens of rounds of golf, maybe hundreds. I don't know. We spent a lot of time together. We spent a lot of time just sitting in his living room talking. And he gave me a great deal of wisdom and a great deal of useful wherewithal for keeping my emotions in check and keeping my life going. There was a moment when I was desperately disappointed and upset with some things that had happened at ABC, and I felt like my career was going into the dumper, and I was so disturbed. And I thought to myself, who can help me? Who can tell me something that might make me feel better? And it occurred to me that I had always observed that I thought that actors had wildly insecure careers, and you make a great movie and then you make a clunker, and you know, one minute you're on top of the world and a little later you're down at the bottom, and how do you deal with all that? And I called Jack and said, can I come up and sit in your living room and get some advice, because I think you might be the only person who can help me. And I drove up to Mulholland Drive and sat down and chatted with him for a while and told him all the horrible things that were happening in my life. And at the end, he said, Lamp, two pieces of advice. Point one, regardless of what the network asks you to do, whatever it is, your job is to go and do that as well as anybody in the world has ever done it. And if you can, make it better. If they send you to do the cheerleading championships, your job is to be the best cheerleading commentator in the world. Remember, there are no small parts, only small actors. That's point one. That was good. It helped a little bit. The second one helped a great deal more. And that was, he said, always remember, always remember, longevity is lovability. If you hang around long enough, they've got no effing choice other than to love you. And that, for a public life, is the truest piece of wisdom I was ever given. Longevity's lovability. If you hang around long enough, they've got no effing choice other than to love you. I hung around 40 some odd years. So I got it. Thank you, Jack.
Let me just ask you two quick ones. You can answer them with single words if you like. Who was the better golfer, you or Jack?
His scorecards were better than mine.
And the other thing was, we started at the top talking about Clay Liston in Florida, and obviously your great friend Larry was there, but you didn't see each other there, right?
Larry was, obviously, he was sports editor of the Philadelphia Daily News at that moment. I was a kid who had saved lawn mowing and car washing money for months to buy a ticket that, foolishly, I didn't save. I don't remember whether that ticket was $100 or $150, but I remember that I saved lawn mowing and car washing money for months to go and see my idol, Cassius Clay, beat Sonny Liston. And my entire neighborhood was filled with people who said, you're crazy, you're a moron, Liston's going to pulverize him, et cetera, et cetera. And when I got home, past midnight, my mother had driven around in Miami Beach killing time until I came out. And when we got home, I got up on the roof, the tile roof of our crappy stucco rented house in Southwest Miami. She was learning how to sell life insurance. My father had died when I was 5 years old. And I got up on the roof and started shouting, I've upset the world. I'm the greatest of all time. And my mother came out and said, get down off the roof before you get us both arrested. And that was the first truly great night of my life.
Jim, this has been absolutely wonderful.
I was 14. And last one about Nicholson?
Yes.
Best line ever on a golf course, all right? You play golf?
Yes, yeah.
Almost certainly you do. So the second hole I'm ever playing with Jack, we're at the Lakeside Golf Club in Burbank, California. And I'm in the cart with him, and he's driving the cart, of course. And I'm in the passenger seat of the cart, and I'm pinching myself. I'm sitting in a golf cart with Jack Nicholson. How am I even going to focus on hitting the ball? So the second hole is a long par five, and I drive the ball into the middle of the fairway, a little bit farther than Jack, and Jack drives it down the left side, and it bounces into a fairway bunker. And pretty hard to make par from that particular fairway bunker, unless you've got another method. And Jack walks around the back of the cart, and I'm watching, and he pulls out a fairway wood. And I'm thinking, what's that about? And he walks into the bunker, and he picks up the ball, and he walks around behind the cart, and he tosses the ball onto a pretty good lie in the fairway. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, I see. And before he addresses the ball for practice swings, turns and looks at me and says, recreation lamp, not self-discovery. Recreation, not self-discovery. Made a par on that hole, or at least a par on the scorecard. Jack could play. He was pretty good. He was a better putter than I am, or was. I don't play golf anymore, because both hips have been dislocated and I can't do that anymore. But he was definitely a better putter than I was.
So I think you've got two books in you, Jim. One, obviously, about your life and times and career, which I believe is on the way. And then one on your golf times with Jack, which is probably a book in its own right.
I see it as one book, but I don't have a publisher yet. So let's hope somebody buys in. I'm sure it'll happen somewhere down the road. Maybe I still have some story collecting to do.
Brilliant, Jim. Well, thank you so much. I'm extraordinarily grateful. This has been absolutely everything I hoped it would be and more.
Sorry it's so long, but you asked all the questions. I provided all the answers.
It's been perfect.
And hail to Terrence Crawford for a great performance.
Jim, thank you so much for your time. I'm grateful.
See you later.
Bye-bye.
I don't know if I'd heard many of those stories before, but the stories behind some of the great lines in boxing history were truly immense. Regardless of whether you're a hardcore fan or not, this was so good, and you need to go back and listen to those calls on YouTube. That was wonderful by Jim, and I don't know how a podcast I had looked forward to so much exceeded my expectations, but it really did. Jim is such a pro, but also a really good guy. A few things before I leave you for the week. I have a few paperback copies of Damage here and some hardback copies of Warrior. If you'd like one, please send me a DM. Congratulations to Peter Steele for winning the Roots of Fight competition for the Fight of the Century jogging bottoms. This week you can win the Kronk jacket and vest bundle by telling me which colleague of Jim's collected them for the airport the first time they met. Just DM me or tag me and Roots of Fight into a post on social media. This is a very cool prize. Thanks to Roots of Fight for working with me. Thanks also to my sponsors, Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, they help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, and they're a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They provide expert, impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance, and you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. You can get episodes in advance on my Patreon at patreon.com/TrisDixon, where I also upload videos, including this week my thoughts and observations from being in Las Vegas for Crawford Spence and my thoughts on the white AJ situation this week. Thanks to Hall of Famer Jim Lampley for taking the time to talk to me. Thanks to you for listening, and I'll be back next week.